From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, so far Republicans have failed to kill Obamacare, but Senator Elizabeth Warren says the fight to save it is not over.
There are still those across the country who want to fight to roll back health care coverage for millions of Americans, and it means we have to be vigilant.
We'll hear from the presidents of two Boston-based community health centers about what ails the current health care system and how to fix it. Also today, the story of the lucrative opium trade in 19th century Boston.
That money changes the face of Boston.
Plus, when Bob Dylan crashed Newport and shook up the folk world more than 50 years ago.
Most of what we call the 60s begins then, and the music is rock and roll, not folk music.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with the latest from the White House in a story about what might be the briefest tenure yet within the Trump administration. Anthony Scaramucci, the newly installed White House communications director, is out just 10 days after he was appointed and just a few days after he delivered an obscenity-laden tirade against members of the president's senior staff. Joining us now from Washington with the latest on this late-breaking story is Matt Visor. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. And Matt, good to have you. Tell us what we know. I know this story is just coming together, but tell us what we know.
So what we know, and the White House has just confirmed this with a statement that Anthony Scaramucci is leaving his role as White House Communications Director. The stated rationale so far is that they thought it was good to give the new Chief of Staff sworn in today, John Kelly, a clean slate to build his own team. From all accounts, it appears that Kelly did have some role in this, that they were trying to start with somebody new, but it is very striking given the musical chairs that have been going on at the White House with resignation after resignation. You remember Sean Spicer about a week ago resigned because of Anthony Scaramucci being appointed in the first place to the position. And Reince Priebus ousted on Friday, partly over comments from Anthony Scaramucci.
Right. That's ironic because, of course, John Kelly replaced Reince Priebus, and he was very much one of the targets of Scaramucci's attack, that sort of obscenity-laden attack that he gave to Ryan Lizza of the New Yorker. So all kinds of musical chairs going on down there. What does it tell you, Matt? I mean, if it's the case that this is a result of John Kelly, the president's newly appointed chief of staff, if that's the case, what does it tell you about Kelly's approach?
I mean, potentially that they are trying to start fresh. If you want the Trump presidency to be successful, the optimistic view is that it's a new era with John Kelly, and weeks like last week, which was chaotic, and unsuccessful by all accounts within the White House, then John Kelly comes in and restores some order, and from now on, things go much more smoothly. Whether that happens, we'll believe it when we see it. He's got a principle in the President Trump to sort of corral some of his instincts toward tweeting and going off script. So I think John Kelly will have a job on his hands. But at least the early indication is that he is starting to try and start fresh with people who he trusts. One sort of just added point is that Scaramucci had said that he was reporting not to the chief of staff but directly to the president. So if you're the chief of staff now, you do not have a communications director who is, reporting to the president just like him.
Right. So Scaramucci out as communications director. Do we know if, in fact, he is out of the White House altogether, or is that not clear yet?
We don't know that yet. You know, there are some indications maybe he has a different job within the administration, doing something else. You know, but before this, he was, you know, he did have a role as well at the Ex-Im Bank. So whether he goes back to that, you know, it is a little bit unclear at this moment. The White House statement said, "We wish him all the best," you know, which seems to indicate that he would not have some intimate role, at least in the West Wing.
All right. Well, that's Matt Visor, White House reporter, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, with the latest about Anthony Scaramucci out as White House Communications Director. Matt Visor, thanks as always. Good to have you.
Thanks so much.
Let's turn now to health care and whether the debate over the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, where it goes from here. Last week, after years of campaigning on a promise of repeal and months of trying to get it done, Senate Republicans failed to muster the votes. And Republican leader Mitch McConnell threw in the towel and said it's time to move on. Well, today, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren was back home visiting the East Boston Neighborhood Health Center, where she characterized the Republican failure to repeal Obamacare as a victory.
What happened last week was a triumph for democracy. It was enough people across America saying health care is a basic human right, and we will stand up and fight for basic human rights. It is not a partisan issue. It's a human issue.
WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown was with Senator Warren in East Boston today. And Steve, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
So give us a sense. What was Senator Warren's central message today?
Well, it was part victory lap and it was part cautionary tale. She wanted to thank the folks at the community health centers for doing what they do to keep people healthy, and also to thank them for keeping the pressure on Congress not to repeal the ACA. But she also warned that there are still people across the country who want to roll back health care for millions of Americans.
Right. Now, Steve, on Saturday, the president tweeted, unless the Republican senators are total quitters, repeal and replace is not dead. Demand another vote before voting on any other bill. And in a speech on Friday in New York, the president criticized senators for failing to pass the Obamacare repeal. Here's what he said.
We're going to get it done. You know, I said from the beginning, let Obamacare implode and then do it. I turned out to be right. Let Obamacare implode.
So, Steve, did Warren say anything about that? Does she regard this fight is over and done with?
Not at all. She says this fight is not over. She warns it could come back at any moment. She urged continued vigilance, adding that we cannot move backwards. Now, as you can imagine, she had some harsh words for President Trump following his comments over the weekend.
The president is threatening a tantrum because he didn't get his way on health care. And like any child who's throwing a tantrum, he doesn't care who gets hurt. And that is fundamentally wrong.
Now, Senator Warren said it is the job of the president to make life a little better for most Americans, not to drive up costs, not to break the health care system, which she says would hurt people across the country.
Steve, now that the Republican effort to repeal Obamacare is done for now, did Senator Warren suggest the possibility of Democrats and Republicans coming together to fix the current system, to fix the Affordable Care Act?
She did. And I asked her specifically if she has heard privately from some of her Republican colleagues about their willingness to make fixes to the ACA. She says that she has, but when I pressed, she wouldn't say specifically what they're willing to do. She said we just have to see what can develop from that and that it's way too early at this point. She sounded a bit optimistic, though, that enough Republicans will shift over to finding a fix.
All right. And tell us why Senator Warren came to the East Boston Neighborhood Health Center specifically. What was she doing there?
Well, she holds the community health centers like the East Boston Neighborhood Health Center and others around the state as examples of something that's working. She said that they show the rest of America that this is the way to bring high-quality health care to all the people and at the same time keep costs down.
All right. WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown reporting today from the East Boston Community Health Center. Thank you, Steve. It's good to have you.
Thanks, Anthony.
For a little more perspective from some healthcare providers on the front lines of this debate, we're joined now by Manny Lopes. He's president and CEO of the East Boston Neighborhood Health Center, where Elizabeth Warren was earlier today. And Manny Lopes, good to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Bill Walczak. He's president and CEO of the South End Community Health Center. He's also a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Council, which helps advance the mission of WBUR. Bill Walczak, good to have you in.
Thanks.
So let me start with you, Manny Lopes. You met with Senator Warren this morning, gave her a tour of your health center. What was the message that you wanted her to understand?
I would say first we wanted to show the center the great work that was going on at the health center, how much we've grown since the signing of the ACA, the community that we're serving, and some of the special programs that we have as a large safety net, acute care facility. We have programs that you would see at any other health center, frankly, across the country that's focused on primary care. But we all develop programs that are also unique to our communities. And for us, that included our 24/7 emergency department, our program of all-inclusive care for the elderly, also known as PACE, our integration of behavioral health services, and then our investment in technology, where we're really trying to not only bring high-quality care at the community level, as you would expect, but also creating more efficiency so we could try to drive down costs.
Well, let me ask you how this whole debate has been sort of playing out in the universe that you oversee in a community health center like the one that you run. In many ways, this national debate continues. The president says he wants the Senate to try again to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Let me just ask you a basic question. What effect would that have on a health care facility like yours?
It could really be devastating, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. You know, the expansion of Medicaid has really allowed us to serve a much larger population, and it's given our patients, frankly, confidence as they enter our facilities that they have coverage and, of course, coverage and access to needed care. And since we're in the business of preventative care, this really helps bring down the cost and, frankly, keeps individuals productive and working in our communities.
And Bill Walczak, let me bring you in on this. As CEO of the South End Community Health Center, same question to you. As you've been watching this debate about whether or not Obamacare gets repealed, what's been going through your mind?
Just how fundamentally flawed the way in which we think about healthcare is in this country. If you think about a healthcare system, what's the purpose of it? The purpose of it is to make sure that we have a healthy population. How do you make sure we don't have a healthy population? Close off access. You close off access to care by making it too difficult, too expensive, too whatever, so that people will not go to it. So you have the number one cause of bankruptcy in the United States being health care cost. This is not the case anywhere else in our planet, of at least civilized countries in our planet. And so what we need to do is we need to make sure that we have easy access to primary care so that we can avoid the higher cost elements of the healthcare system, like getting an operation, like making sure that you don't wind up with cancer if it's avoidable. These are issues that we have to face as a country, and yet our healthcare system seems to be devoid of that kind of thought. How do we keep us healthy as a country?
Interesting. So in other words, it seems to be, I mean, what I've been struck by the debate in Washington over the last several months is we seem to have waged a pretty interesting debate about an insurance industry. I'm not sure if we've really been talking about healthcare. Would you gentlemen agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, coverage without access is not healthcare.
Yeah.
You need access to healthcare and the right level of access, the right care at the right time. And again, being in the business of primary care and preventative care, we are laser focused in making sure that our patients in the community gets the care, again, at the right time and in the right setting, as well as in a culturally sensitive way.
Well, so suffice it to say, I've got two guests in here who are obviously opposed to the idea of repealing Obamacare. You've made that really clear, and that it's all about maintaining and increasing access to health care. But what How do you view the problems that exist with the current system? I mean, you don't have to work too hard. I'm sure you encounter problems like this or comments like this all the time when people come into your facilities, that the markets are thin in some states. Premium and other out-of-pocket expenses are going up for a lot of people. The cost of prescription drugs is high. So there is a need for some kind of improvement out there. And that seems to be, again, getting back to this debate in Washington, what the Democrats would like to do with the Republicans. From where you sit, and I'll start with you, Bill Walczak, what kind of improvements need to happen to the Affordable Care Act?
The first thing is to get away from the notion that somehow the marketplace is going to solve this problem. Low-income people have been kept out of the healthcare system forever, and as a result, they have shorter lifespans and more disease and more problems, which is not good for our economy, not good for anything that our country is planning on doing in the future. So the first thing we need to do is think about this from a different perspective, which is that if we only view this as a marketplace type of thing, what we're going to wind up with is outrageously high cost, because the insurance companies are going to want to make sure that they're covered for catastrophic care. And catastrophic care is enormously expensive. So right now what's going on is that we have a system in which the deductibles are going up dramatically. And so it's just to give you an idea, the place I work, South End Health Center, we had three really catastrophic cases in our health, in our employees that resulted in an increase of 28% in our cost of healthcare, our premium cost for healthcare. And in order to avoid that catastrophic increase for people that are making $15 an hour or more, what we did was we increased our deductible to $3,000 for an individual or $6,000 for a family. If you're making $15 an hour, how do you afford that? Yet this is exactly the direction we're going in, and exactly the reason why expanded Medicaid was the best aspect of the Obamacare initiative, and why we need to protect Medicaid at all costs and expand it for that matter. We have people who are making really low income, people that are considered working class in our country right now, that cannot afford the deductibles on it and will go bankrupt if something catastrophic happens to them.
Well, that gets to my question. So how do we deal with that? I mean, clearly that is a huge defect with the current system. I'm not saying therefore repeal and replace, but how do we deal with that?
All of us that have been working in healthcare for a really long time and care for poor people know that the only real solution is a single payer system. But since that seems to be off the table for generations now, although right now there's some discussion about it, because we know that if we were able to control access and understand what was necessary and not necessary, that we would be able to decrease the cost of healthcare. Despite the fact that our market is involved in this healthcare system, we have the highest cost healthcare system in the world by far.
Yeah. Manny Loeb, same question to you. I mean, as you look at the population that you serve facing challenges, affording deductibles, whatever it is, what do you see as the biggest challenge in the current system that you would like to fix?
I would say I agree with a lot of what Bill just said, but I would add that we have to come together as a society and as a country, that we're all in this together, knowing that today if someone shows up in our emergency department, we are required by law to treat anyone who walks in our doors. Now, if that individual does not have insurance coverage, that means those of us who are sitting around this table today, and those of you listening at home, we share in that responsibility to pay for those services. So there have been many studies that have shown preventative care is a lot less expensive than emergency care. So if we all agree that we should be in this together and making sure people get care when they need it, then hopefully we could drive down the cost of care and we will all save as a society. I would say the second area would be the investment that's needed in primary care. We have a huge primary care provider shortage across the country, here in the city of Boston and particularly in rural America. And we need to make an effort to make a significant investment in primary care. That means training more primary care providers, and that means increasing the level of reimbursement that primary care providers receive. And I think if we were able to do that, then again, we would have hopefully an opportunity to not only improve access, but again, bring down the cost.
Bill, what's it been like for you following this debate for the last many months to unravel Obamacare? I mean, I'm just curious. I mean, you oversee doctors, nurses, healthcare providers. What's it been like to work in those conditions?
Well, I mean, the fear factor for patients is enormous. South End Health Center, about 70% of the patients are on Medicaid. Many of them are immigrants, and so they look at it as, wow, I'm going to be thrown off of healthcare. I'm not going to be able to deal with it. I may get thrown out of the country. And so that's been really scary, and it's actually caused a lot of people from getting their health care. They've stopped coming in because they're afraid or whatever. They think that health centers are going to be places where ICE would be hanging out in the door waiting for somebody. So that is a problem. But beyond that, personally, watching this, it's like, get back to the future. I mean, back in the 70s when I was involved in starting the Cobham Square Health Center, you know, the big issue was that the only place people could get health care was in the emergency room of hospitals. That was primary care. That was your pregnancy care. That was, you know, immunizations for your child to get into school. And it looks like we are, as a country, are moving backwards into that direction again. And this has got to be stopped. We have to get together, as Manny says, you know, as a country, and just say, for God's sake, you know, healthcare should be a right. We shouldn't be preventing people from getting basic access to care.
Manny Lopes, I'll give the last word to you, but you're nodding your head there. Do you want anything you want to add to that?
No, I think Bill, once again, said it very clearly. I think we all need to agree that we're all in this together. The Affordable Care Act was a great progress forward, but we still have more work to do. It's not perfect. And if we come together, we could try to work with the challenges and work with the program that we have today and really try to do what's best, because healthcare, as Bill clearly mentioned, healthcare, we strongly believe, is a right, not a privilege.
All right. Well, that's Manny Lopes. He's president and CEO of East Boston Neighborhood Health Center, and Bill Walczak, president and CEO of the South End Community Health Center. Gentlemen, thank you both for coming in.
Thank you, Anthony.
Appreciate it. Stay with us. Coming up, the parents of Charlie Gard ended the legal battle to save their son's life, but lots of ethical questions remain. We're going to talk about some of those coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. For months, the parents of Charlie Gard, the critically ill baby from the United Kingdom, fought a legal battle seeking possible experimental treatment for their son in the United States. Last week, after they were told the treatment was no longer an option, they ended their battle and let their son die. Here's Charlie's father, Chris Gard, in London last week.
As Charlie's devoted and loving parents, we have decided that it's no longer in Charlie's best interests to pursue treatment, and we will let our son go and be with the angels.
On Friday, after doctors removed Charlie from life support, he died just short of his first birthday. Now, a post on WBUR's Common Health blog about the ethical issues brought up by the case went viral over the last few days, and here to tell us more about that is Common Health host Carrie Goldberg. Carrie, good to see you.
You too, Anthony.
So this is such a sad, tragic story, a baby mm-hmm. with a fatal genetic disease, parents determined to do anything they could to save him.
Yes, so sad and so fraught with difficult issues. It involved a pitched legal battle that pitted the parents against the hospital, the great Ormond Street Hospital in London. And the hospital was arguing for life support to be withdrawn, saying, you know, there was no hope for the baby and that he was suffering. The parents not only fought in court, they used a crowdfunding campaign to raise more than $1.5 million to pay for this possible treatment that Charlie might be able to get in the U.S., even though I have to say the treatment was so unproven that I wouldn't even call it experimental. I'd call its potential benefit just purely theoretical. I mean, it hadn't even been done in animals before with his mutation.
I see. And the battle got lots of attention that even the Pope, President Trump, tweeted about mm-hmm. it. The Pope tweeted about the duty to defend human life, and Trump basically offered American help for the baby.
Right. He said we'd be delighted to help if we can. But you know, a lot of the social media response was, shall we say, less positive. And some of the medical staffers at the hospital were getting really nasty messages and even death threats, according to the hospital's director. So our Common Health columnist on medical ethics, Paul McLean, wrote a post about how not only should the nurses and others who care for terminally ill babies not get death threats, it's pretty obvious.
Pretty basic, right?
Yeah,
right,
come on. But their views should be accorded special consideration because they're the ones at the bedside. They're the ones like running the ventilator and providing all the other care that's needed for a baby like Charlie Gard who couldn't even breathe or move on his own.
So he's not saying the nurses and other caregivers should get to make the decision,
no.
Just that they should be heard throughout the process.
Right. But he also points out that, you know, this kind of heartbreaking work can really lead to burnout among these caregivers that I would call angelic. You know, they're doing amazing work. And in fact, he writes about a friend who had a baby in a similar situation to Charlie Gard's and insisted on every possible intervention, just like Charlie Gard's parents did. And later, this friend not only came to regret it because they were convinced that it prolonged the baby's suffering, but also found out that some of the nurses had opted out of the baby's care. They just couldn't do it. And one stuck with it right to the end and then quit, just couldn't take it anymore. So Paul McLean is pointing out that nurses and other caregivers are a precious resource, and that's a factor to consider in a case like this. Or at the very least, just don't send them nasty messages, right?
Right. Now, a lot of people who treasure nurses and agree with you and this post, and that's why this post really went viral. So give us a sense of some of the reaction to it.
So there were just fascinating and really wrenching responses from nurses who have been there in cases like this. And one wrote, "Our fragile, sympathetic hearts can only take so much, whether from the emotional roller coasters from caring for our patients or from the verbal abuse we take." She wrote, "My heart has footprints all over it." Mm. And others talked about how hard it is to care for a child who, you know, a child full of tubes, they're in bed forever, no chance of getting better. It's just brutal.
Right, right. So some of the controversy here was over whether the baby was suffering. I mean, life is precious, to be sure, but life of only suffering, a much more complicated question.
It is more complicated. And suffering itself is a complicated question because it's subjective and you're trying to figure out whether they're suffering or not. But so, right. So in that sense, this was kind of a right to die, or I guess really a right to live case, you know, living versus living but suffering. But there's another really tricky ethical issue at the heart of this case, and I would call it more like a right to try issue. Like, should you be able to try anything, even if the chances are, you know, vanishingly small that it could work? And in this case, you know, Charlie Gard's parents were saying, look, we've raised this money. We've got this $1.5 million. We should be able to buy him this treatment in the U.S. And so the question is, if you're paying for it yourself, should you be able to buy any medical treatment you want, even if it's totally unproven?
It's such an interesting question. And I guess I have two thoughts, sort of two reactions to it. I mean, if I'm fighting for the possibility to save my child's life, even a remote possibility, I want that right. On the other hand, I can look at it sort of a little more dispassionately and say this raises the issue of care only for those who can pay, and that seems troubling too.
That's very troubling, especially in a country where there are, you know, cuts looming to Medicaid and so on. But it's also a question of whether it's actually okay for you to be able to pay personally for care that is arguably a communal, community good. So you want that option, but it might not be in your interest or in society's best interest. And I spoke with Dr. Robert Trug. He's the director of the Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical School. And he wrote a really cogent piece about this case in the journal JAMA. He makes the point that saying, well, don't worry, I'll pay the medical bills out of my own pocket, is kind of like saying, don't worry, I'll pay for the fire engine to come to my house, in that it's just not that simple. Like, there's been a communal investment in your town's fire department. And he says, we have a communal investment in healthcare, and especially the kind of care that Charlie Gard needed, which is very advanced care in what's called a tertiary care hospital. And so he says it's up to healthcare professionals to make sure it's used wisely.
You know, I think of the intensive care unit where I work. We are always full. And I think we have a responsibility to make sure that we are using our services for children that can most benefit from what we're doing.
Now, Anthony, I did push back a little bit and I said, okay, but what if I say I'll pay anything you want? I'll pay more than just the incremental cost of this treatment. I'll pay whatever you say is enough to cover this treatment any way you look at it. And Dr. Trug still says no go.
nobody could actually pay to create an additional bed in the intensive care unit. You know, it simply doesn't exist. It's not part of the building. I mean, truly, every single day, almost every single day, those beds are completely full. We are having to turn people away, delay their surgeries, because we don't have the resources. So it's not just a question of money. I mean, it's what is physically available.
So, Kerry, it sounds like Dr. Trug is saying that we have to look past not only the money and the emotion, but even that rush of empathy you get when you see parents fighting for their baby's life, as we did in this very sad case.
Right, and who wouldn't feel the same way? But that's right. And I asked Dr. Trug about the Pope and the President weighing in on behalf of Charlie's parents.
The Pope and President Trump were responding, as I think all of us would, which is our heart goes out to families like this. And so that natural response is there for all of us, not just for them. But then we need to think it through a little bit more and think about, you know, all of the children who are sick in the world, and how do we fairly treat all of them in the best way possible. And that's where the decisions get more complicated.
So he says, you know, feeling that empathy has to be just the beginning of how we have to think about these issues. And we have to hope that there's a lot more thinking about this, because they're likely to come up increasingly, cases like this, in particular as more highly experimental and highly expensive treatments come along.
Boy, a deep and sad and very deep story, though. Kerry Goldberg, host of WBR's Common Health blog, thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And listeners, you can find a link to the column on the Charlie Gard column at our website, radioboston.org. Thanks, as always, Kerry.
You're welcome.
There's a trove of musical instruments on display at the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art in North Adams that can make you feel like Jack from Jack and the Beanstalk, waiting for the giant to return for a jam session. They're in an installation called No Experience Required, where everyone is encouraged to play the Franken instruments created by beloved Bennington College professor Gunnar Schoenbeck. Schoenbeck died in 2005, and when his collection needed a home, another musician, who's also Paul Simon's music director, helped bring it to MassMoCA. WBUR artery reporter Andrea Shea spoke with him and brings us a sound piece about the interactive Gunnar Schoenbeck installation.
My name is Mark Stewart, and I'm standing here in the new Building 6 of MassMoCA, and I'm going to play for you the 9-foot banjo. To make a 9-foot banjo, you need a giant drum. Because a banjo is just a drum with a neck put on it. When Gunnar went to make a 9-foot banjo, he needed a big drum. I had heard tales of these remarkable instruments. And so when I got word that they were at risk, and that if I wanted to see them, I would have to move quickly, I moved quickly. And when I discovered this fantastic collection, the very first day I walked in, and I knew they had to be preserved. Bennington, of course, was looking for a path for this remarkable work, and they were not able to offer institutional support anymore. The great man himself was no longer alive. It's a remarkable collection, but it's huge. Suddenly you realize you're looking at the inside of a piano. All the mechanisms, all the furniture has been stripped away, and you're stuck with all these strings laid bare for us all to play, to touch, to pluck, to whack, to bow, to sing into and hear the sympathetic resonance. You know, just a wonderful idea. And he had four of these in the space at Bennington. Four pianos he had saved from the dumpster and laid out on these rolling tables so that they could be moved around and played. That doesn't mean it's easy to roll them. Over here, straight across, looks like a swing set, but it's bedecked with wonderful pieces of wood. It's a vertical xylophone. He didn't do any grave robbing, but he certainly did some dumpster diving. And there is nothing like that, a really fine city dump, to find some great sound-making materials. let's make a 2x4 marimba that's 12 feet long. Let's make some conga drums out of jet fighter fuel tanks. Let's grab a bunch of leaf springs from the dump and weld them onto a scuba tank and make who knows what. We'll find out after we do it. And then, whoa, that's pretty cool. And on to the next one, you know. That was his trip. There on the wall, one of Gunnar's quotes, everything has its sound, you just have to bring it out. And if you believe that, then every man's trash is your treasure. There's very few things that don't have potential for sound making. And Gunnar certainly understood that.
That is pretty cool. That was Mark Stewart, musician and the curator behind the installation of Gunnar Schoenbeck's gigantic musical instruments, now on display at Mass MoCA, just opening, which just opened in Building 6. Our sound portrait was produced by WBUR's Andrea Shea. And we have pictures of the instruments on our website. You can go to radioboston.org to see them. Stay with us coming up when Bob Dylan crashed Newport and shook up the folk world more than 50 years ago. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The Newport Folk Festival concluded this weekend with performances by Wilco, John Prine, Billy Bragg, the Avett Brothers, and Suzanne Vega, to name just a few of the artists. We want to return to one of the most famous and controversial performances ever to take place there. It was 1960, and Bob Dylan took the stage with a Stratocaster electric guitar. Backed by Al Kooper and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, Dylan tore through a blistering version of Maggie's Farm. Many in the crowd booed. Die-hard folk fans were outraged by Dylan's embrace of hard-driving electric rock and roll. It was said that folk singer and activist Pete Seeger tried to grab an axe to cut through the cables and silence the racket. Elijah Wald, a Medford-based musician and writer, explores this pivotal moment in folk rock history in his book Dylan Goes Electric, Newport, Seeger, Dylan, and the Night That Split the 60s, which came out in 2015, 50 years after that explosive night. This has been quite a year for Bob Dylan, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature, so we thought we'd revisit our conversation about that night at Newport with Elijah Wald, who begins his book with the question, why, after all these years, does that particular performance still have such significance? Now, I know you wrote a whole book to answer that question, but what's the quick answer to that question?
There have to be at least two quick answers. One of them is Dylan still has a lot of fans, and they are very serious about him, and they still care very deeply about him. But I think the other thing is there was a real historical divide around 1965, between the first half of the 60s, where folk music had gone along with the civil rights movement, you know, We Shall Overcome, which was coming from Pete Seeger and the folk scene. And then 1965, the weekend that Dylan went on stage, is the weekend that Lyndon Johnson doubled the forces in Vietnam and committed us to a ground war. And most of what we call the 60s begins then, and the music is rock and roll, not folk music. And the issues, certainly for young white kids, become much more personal and much less about marching in the South shoulder to shoulder with African Americans and much more about, you know, growing their hair, listening to rock and fighting their own battles.
Really interesting. So let's listen to Dylan singing his great song, Mr. Tambourine Man, at Newport in 1964, the year before he went electric.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you.
So there's Dylan in 1964. Tell me how he was viewed then by the folk establishment at this point.
That's a complicated question because there isn't one folk establishment. And that's one of the things that people get wrong about this story. On the one hand, there were some very sincere people who believed in folk music as the voice of, let's say, socially conscious America. There is a very sincere branch of the folk movement that believes that folk music is not a political thing. It's about getting the real sound of the rural styles and this wonderful music, particularly in the South, of blues and country musicians. And then, of course, there are the people who see folk music as the new hot trend, with Peter, Paul and Mary and Joan Baez at number one on the charts. And those are really three different constituencies. Mm. And Dylan had his moment with each of those. Really, his reputation all through this period is he's always a little bit ahead of what's going on. And going electric was one more step in that.
Here's one of his big hits, Like a Rolling Stone, from his Highway 61 Revisited album, which came out in 65, just before Newport. And by the way, he played this in that electric Newport set as well.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Didn't you?
That song had already been released, so why were the folks at Newport so shocked by it?
First of all, it was ungodly loud.
Right.
And there had never been such a thing as a rock festival. Nobody had ever heard anything like that.
How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home? Like a complete unknown. Like a rock.
And if you were standing right up close to the stage, which a lot of the musicians and reporters were, you were hearing the amps, and they were overpowering Dylan's voice, which was just coming over the PA. So people right up front were not hearing him. They were just hearing the band. But the other thing is, a lot of the reason that people were angry was because this hit single was on the radio and because a huge number of people had shown up at Newport to hear Bob Dylan, the new pop star, and had no interest in hearing Cousin Emmy and Roscoe Holcomb and Son House, and were running around looking for Donovan and Dylan and Baez and Peter, Paul and Mary and ignoring what the festival was supposed to be about. And by the time Dylan went on stage, there were a lot of people already feeling like the festival was kind of being ruined by the new pop atmosphere.
Huh. Interesting.
The folk boom really was ending.
Interesting. I want to ask you about the reaction of the great folk icon and activist Pete Seeger. He didn't, in fact, chop the cables with an axe. But here he is talking a couple of years ago, shortly before he died, about that performance in 1965 at Newport. Here he is.
I was furious that the sound was so distorted you could not understand a word that he was singing. He was singing a great song, Maggie's Farm, a great song. But you couldn't understand it. And I ran over to the sound man and said, fix the sound so you can understand him. And they hollered back, no, this is the way they want it. But I was so mad, I said, damn, if I had an axe, I'd cut the cable right now. I really was that mad.
I love hearing Pete Seeger. But talk about how he fits into all of this.
A lot of people don't really understand who Pete Seeger was. And in a way, if you never saw him live, you never can understand who he was because it's not on the records. Mm. His whole magic was about getting us all singing together and about the idea that the guy on stage was just part of this mass of people who were all joining their voices.
Interesting. So if you have a guy who's over-amplified and you can't understand what he's singing about, what's the point?
In fact, what Dylan himself said is, I found this quote later on, he talks about Pete, he says, you know, he was sort of like a shaman. I mean, he led the community, and rock musicians aren't that. They're just living out people's fantasies. But it is true that one of the things that bothered Pete was the whole star system. I mean, the whole idea of Newport, and Seeger, incidentally, had invented, he and his wife Toshi, the idea of Newport, was that the stars would come, take a tiny bit of money, and their fans would subsidize a festival that would bring all these unknown rural musicians up north or out of the country where you could see them. And obviously, when Dylan walked on stage with a rock band, that was not what was going on.
Well, on that score, you also confront this myth that Dylan was sort of this pure folk musician who suddenly embraced rock and roll and betrayed the folk revival movement. You make the point that Dylan had long been attracted to rock and roll.
Dylan, when he hit Greenwich Village as a folk singer, he hit as the folk singer with rock and roll energy. And once people said that to me, my first reaction was, what are you talking about?
Highway 51 runs right by my baby's door.
Then I went back to the first album, which I've owned my entire life. And I was listening and went, wait a minute, he's playing the Everly Brothers Wake Up Little Susie riff behind Highway 51. And my first thought was, I've just discovered something. My next thought was, wait a minute, it says that in the liner notes.
Right, he mentions people like Carl Perkins, the Everly Brothers, and Elvis Presley as his big influences.
Right, yeah. And that was all there right at the very beginning. Yeah. But what happened was, after Blowing in the Wind hit, all of that suddenly disappeared. I mean, they had been promoting him as a hot, young, energetic blues singer. That's all the rap on the first Dylan album. 51 no more.
Isn't how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Blowing in the Wind, of course. Now, songs like that fueled the idea that Dylan was sort of the musical voice of the anti-Vietnam War movement. But you sort of put that in perspective as well.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is we do think of him that way, but of course Dylan's songs survived as the voice of the anti-Vietnam War movement, but the war in Vietnam wasn't yet happening from a United States point of view when he was writing this stuff.
He didn't really want that role, did he?
It definitely was scary to him when he became sort of hailed as a leader and was put in a couple of really, really difficult situations. I tell in the book in some detail, he was given the Tom Paine Award by the Emergency Civil Liberties Union, and he was supposed to give this acceptance speech that just turned into a disaster. Hmm. And he was drunk and he got booed. And I think he just learned that that was not a role that he was suited for.
And what about his response to that 1965 performance at Newport?
He suggests that his old fans are still with him and that the people who were upset are the people who discovered him through Peter, Paul and Mary. And I think that's probably about right. I mean, what he never sounded mellow. And the idea of folk music, the idea of folk rock is mostly mellow. I mean, it's fascinating to me that people keep talking about Dylan as if he is like the birds. And he wasn't. He wasn't a sweet harmony singer. He was like the Rolling Stones. Mm-hmm. I mean, the song Like a Rolling Stone that was on the charts right then was Satisfaction, which is a pure Dylan imitation.
I tried. What explains that Dylan has been able to stay in the festival's good graces after, for so long, since 1965?
Well, I mean, I think Dylan's whole approach to music, in a sense, is exactly what most of the groups at Newport are doing now. I mean, Dylan really pioneered a deep, deep interest in traditional music and still does. Fiddles, be it electric guitars, be it mandolins. He still has, he defines a roots music aesthetic combined with doing his own material, coming up with new twists on things. And I think if you look at the Newport lineup, the idea that you've got a roots connection and are trying to do your own thing is very much what the festival's about. So clearly he's the eminence grise of that particular aesthetic.
Elijah Wald is a Medford-based writer and musician. His book is Dylan Goes Electric, Newport, Seeger, Dylan, and the Night That Split the 60s. Elijah, it was a great pleasure. Thanks for this book, and thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Once upon a
time, we spoke to Elijah Wald back in 2015. His book is now out in paperback, by the way. I'm Anthony Brooks. That's it for today. This is Radio Boston. Everybody that was